May it please the court, my name is Rich Rodriguez with the law firm of Duncan Ostrander and Dingus, and I represent the Regional Transportation District. In this condemnation case, RTD acquired certain property from 750 West 48th Avenue, LLC, or 750 for RTD's current Fast Tracks project. There were three errors committed by the trial court or commission that affected the outcome of the case or fairness of the trial. The first error occurred when the non-presiding trial court overturned an evidentiary decision by the commission. The second error occurred when the trial court failed to apply the proper legal standard in determining whether to disqualify Commissioner Katie Hook. And the third error occurred when the commission overturned the trial court's legal ruling in limine on certain opinions of expert broker Stephen Serrini. As to the first issue, the trial court lacked the power to reverse the commission's evidentiary decision. The parties disagree whether the standard of review is abuse of discretion or de novo. It's our position that because this issue concerns the court's role under Colorado's eminent domain statute, which is a matter of statutory interpretation or construction, this is subject to de novo review. The trial court exceeded its jurisdiction and authority here under relevant eminent domain statutes. In an eminent domain case, a trial court's role in evaluation trial is very limited. It does not preside over the evaluation trial. This is a matter of practice and a matter of law. In the Vail Associates case, the Colorado Supreme Court said it is not the intent of the statute that the judge of the court should preside over the commission proceedings in the same manner as he's required to do in a jury trial. The commission essentially sits as a civil judge and juror. It may seek the aid of the trial court in resolving evidentiary disputes or issues by statute, but it's not required to do so. And when it doesn't ask the trial court to intervene and rule on the propriety of the proof or any of the objections, its decisions are final. That's the Webb case we cite in the brief. That's the Goldstein case, where the Colorado Supreme Court said in a footnote in that case, specifically, the statutes only provide for judicial review of the commissioner's decisions when the commission requests the trial court to act on those.
Mr. Rodriguez, what about section 38.1.105.1, which says that the, among other things, the trial court shall instruct the commissioners as to the applicable law?
The trial court does have the jurisdiction to issue legal instructions, and the court did issue legal instructions in this case. There's a dispute in this case, obviously, with respect to whether what the trial court indeed did was a legal instruction, or whether it was a limiting instruction, or whether it was merely, as we argue, an overturning of an evidentiary decision.
How do we determine whether it was in one category or the other? What's the difference between the trial court ruling on an evidentiary decision or instructing the commissioners as to the proper law?
Well, first off, the court in issuing a legal instruction has to issue it based on some relevant case or statute or some legal principle. And in this instance, the court did not issue the instruction pursuant to any applicable law. In fact, what the landowner argued in this case is that the court should issue an instruction based on the Marshall Manufacturing case, which we discussed in our brief. And in that case, the court is really merely separating between the admissibility of relocation expenses in a condemnation proceeding. That case cannot be read for the broad proposition that any reference that involves any relocation is inadmissible. We made that record before the trial court that the instruction it was issuing was not consistent with or supported by the Marshall Manufacturing case, and instead was merely a direct disregard of the commission's decision on an evidentiary issue. And the court struggled with that a little bit. And as you saw in our briefs, the court said specifically, what is my duty and my role in overturning a commission's decision? It actually said that in the record. And what the court justified is not, it didn't justify it based on the legal instruction. It said, well, in a typical civil case, if I were presiding over a jury, I have the ability to issue a limiting instruction. And so that's really how I'm viewing this, and that's how I'm going to issue this instruction, is I'm limiting the evidence to clarify it. But the record did not reflect that the landowner had requested any clarification. Theirs is simply a legal argument based on Marshall Manufacturing, and as I said, it was our position, and the record was laid, that Marshall Manufacturing didn't apply to this particular instruction. So we believe the record is sufficiently clear that in this particular instance, not only was the court not requested to issue a instruction of what the law was, but they were requested to overturn an evidentiary decision.
Well, Mr. Rodriguez, what I'm trying to figure out is the question of what is admissible or competent evidence, is that a question of law?
I believe that's a question for the commission to make. And that's a question for the commission to make based on the evidence that's presented before it. And then the commission is bound to apply the legal instructions the court gives at the end of the case with respect to what's relevant in a condemnation case.
Okay, and I guess just to follow that up, so if the court is empowered to issue instructions on all matters of law, why would not that fall under, as far as the question of competence or admissibility of evidence, why would that not fall under a proper instruction for a court to give?
Because a court, in the facts before you and the circumstances present before you, the commission made a decision based on the relevance of the evidence with respect to the issues in the case. The trial court issued a quote-unquote legal instruction that wasn't based on the relevance of the evidence as it was presented to the commission. It was based on its view that the evidence should have not come in.
All right, so your position is, had the commission not already made a decision on that, then the court would have been free to do so, but because the commission made a decision on what would come in as competent evidence?
No, our position is that the trial court had no authority whatsoever to overturn an evidentiary decision of the commission. Whether you do it under the guise of a legal instruction or whether evidence has come in and the trial court just decides it wants to take the issue up, that's not the trial court's role. And it's very important to remember, as I said, that the trial court does not preside over this trial. This is what complicates it, and this is why it makes it an important issue here. When we were arguing this instruction, there was no evidence before the judge. So we're debating why this evidence came into the record. We're debating what it was relevant to, and the trial court had no context whatsoever. It didn't ask to review the transcript. It simply looked at their instruction, which was striking all of this evidence, and said, well, I'm going to do this.
Well, did it strike the evidence?
It did strike the evidence. I don't believe you can read that instruction any other reasonable way. I know that the landowner tries to say that the judge merely clarified it, but I don't think you can read it that way for two reasons. One, you can't read it that way for two reasons. The first reason is because that's not how it was presented to the trial court. The landowner did not request the court to clarify anything. The landowner requested the court to rule this evidence is completely irrelevant. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is, remember, as I said earlier, the whole basis for this objection was the Marshall Manufacturing case, that it was a relocation issue and that it was barred under relocation. There was no request that the trial court merely clarify it. And I submit, Your Honors, that as I said in the briefs, if this were truly an issue that required clarification, number one, it would have been requested. But why is clarification needed? There were many other legal instructions issued with respect to what is the law that applied to the commissioners. And the court actually said that when it was issuing the instructions. So if there was other law that really adequately framed the issue, and it told the commission what was and was not relevant, why was there a need to clarify this evidence? Why couldn't the commission make that assessment of the law, applying it to the facts and the evidence that it had admitted? The only way you can get to that is by realizing what the court did was decide on its own, after not hearing any evidence, after hearing no arguments, that it did not want this evidence to be considered. The reason that this, but if the courts, if your honors believe that the trial court did have the jurisdiction, we believe that the error still was substantial and that it affected the impact of this case or the outcome of this case, and therefore the error was reversible. It's critical for your honors to understand that this was the issue in the case. The dispute between the appraisers was really over the cost approach, which is one of the accepted approaches to value in condemnation. And under that approach, one of the things that's very important to consider is all forms of depreciation. If you have a piece of property, it could depreciate for a number of reasons. It could depreciate just for age. You know, it's an older building, so that's you depreciate a certain element to reduce the value where appropriate. The issue in this case was whether certain improvements 750 had built were super adequate, were atypical of the heavy industrial market, and this evidence that we intended to introduce with respect to the Willow Street property went to that critical issue in the case. And how do you know that this decision impacted the case? Because of the unique circumstances of this condemnation case. This isn't a typical case where a trial court judge decides over a jury. Well, first off, this isn't a hearsay objection on a collateral minor issue. That's number one. But this isn't a typical case where a judge listens to a party's attempt to introduce evidence, and it listens to the other attorney's objection, and then it says, I'm not admitting this evidence, jury, you're not going to hear it. In that case, you have somewhat of a difficult position because you have to, in some ways, infer or speculate or guess as to what would have influenced the jury had this been admitted. In this instance, you don't need to concern yourselves with that, and the issue is much easier because in this case, the commission sat as the judge and the jury. It twice overruled objections from the landowner, and it admitted this evidence, and it said, we want to consider this evidence is important to us, and this evidence went to the critical key issue in the case. So in this particular instance, by the trial court essentially taking away that evidence from RTD, it also took that evidence away from the commission, and it said, even though you think this evidence is important, I'm telling you it's not.
Mr. Rodriguez, if I may interrupt you, I'd like to ask you about a statute that I'm not sure that was cited in any of the briefs. And Section 38.1.101.2a, the statutes provides that all questions and issues except the amount of compensation shall be determined by the court. What bearing do you, if any, do you think that statute might have on this issue?
That we litigate that statutory provision frequently, and I can tell you where that issue comes up is in two respects. It comes up when initially at the beginning of the case when the parties are determining whether or not the government agency or condemner has the ability to condemn, whether they satisfy jurisdictional prerequisites, whether the condemner has negotiated in good faith. All of those issues are the issues that are decided by the court. The only thing the commission decides is just compensation and valuation issues. The other way that statute comes into play is frequently the parties in these cases file in limine motions, and for instance, one specific area of the law is business profits law. And the law is well settled in Colorado that a landowner is not entitled to recover for lost business profits. So, for instance, if an issue came up in a case with respect to business profits, because categorically that's not compensable as a matter of law, that is a question that would be presented to the jury. I would like to reserve for a rebuttal remaining 48 seconds.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jody Alderman of Alderman Bernstein, and we represent the landowner appellee in this case, 750 West 48th Avenue. LLC. The LLC owned the property that RTD took in this case, and Jack and Mary Ryan are the owners of the LLC. Mr. Ryan is also the owner of AAA Waterproofing, which was occupying the property at the time of the taking. It's a commercial waterproofing company, and this is the entity that actually moved to the Willow Street property, which was the subject of the legal instruction that's before the court today. The two of the issues here today relate to evidentiary and instructional decisions. This case was to a three-person commission. The commission chair was retired District Court Judge Naves, and Judge Frick was the presiding judge. And it is correct, she did not sit through the valuation trial, but before trial commenced, she did make a decision on an in limine motion that landowner, our side, had presented, moving to exclude some evidence of a broker that RTD intended to offer. She denied the motion in limine, and after 3 days of trial, the petitioner began to offer that testimony of the broker. We renewed our objection, and at that point, the commission sustained the objection. So that's one of the evidentiary issues on appeal. The other one relates to the instruction that you've been discussing previously with regard to the Willow Street property. This was admitted, this evidence was admitted by the commission over objection of landowner, and during jury instructions, the trial court determined that it would issue the instruction that the evidence was irrelevant and should not be considered by the commission in ascertaining the value of the property. Neither of these situations constitutes reversible error. Under Colorado law, evidentiary decisions are, whether they're in limine or during the course of the trial, are interlocutory, and they can be rescinded or modified during the course of the proceedings, which is exactly what happened in both of these cases. The court has the authority to make in limine rulings in condemnation cases and to issue instructions to the commission under 38.1105. During the course of the valuation proceedings, the commission does have the authority to make evidentiary decisions as well. However, in the Goldstein case, it's explained the commission's discretion to make evidentiary decisions is only present when the evidence is not irrelevant as a matter of law. According to the Colorado Supreme Court in the Belfour case cited in the briefs, the final instructions trump previous in limine and evidentiary rulings. So first, the Willow Street evidence. This is the property to which AAA Waterproofing relocated as a direct result of RTD's taking. They were forced to relocate to the property. There was direct examination of Mr. Ryan related to whether he looked for properties comparable to the subject property for AAA Waterproofing to move. The commission then, on cross-examination, let testimony in about the Willow Street property, as I said, over objection, determining it was in the scope of direct examination, and indicating it could separate whether it goes to value or whether it goes to other issues on direct. And as I said, the commission has discretion to admit evidence, so long as it's not irrelevant as a matter of law. Here, evidence of the Goldstein property is irrelevant as a matter of law, so it's proper for the trial court to issue the instruction. Another case to look at is the Mahaffey case, which was cited in the briefs. It was a similar situation, but in the reverse. There was an instruction offered on evidence that had been admitted in the course of trial. On appeal, the trial court refused to give the instruction in that case. And on appeal, the argument was the court should have given the instruction because the evidence came in and it was irrelevant as a matter of law. The court in that case decided that the trial court properly refused to issue the instruction because the evidence properly came in. So it was a little bit of the reverse, but kind of a similar sort of factual situation. Under 38.1105, it is the duty of the judge to instruct the commission as to the applicable and proper law. And because the Willow Street property evidence came in and is irrelevant as a matter of law, the instruction was properly given. The Marshall Manufacturing case does stand for this legal proposition that relocation evidence is not admissible in the eminent domain valuation trial. In Marshall Manufacturing, the property consisted of land, a building, and some special improvements, the property that was taken. The property owner in that case was relocated and was given relocation monies to recreate these special improvements at the relocation property. The trial court in the eminent domain valuation case excluded evidence of the relocation expenses, and the Court of Appeals affirmed, holding that the eminent domain statutes and the relocation statutes are properly kept separate. So here, the evidence they wanted in is that AAA Waterproofing didn't recreate special improvements at the relocation property. That's what RTD wanted in. And under the holding of Marshall Manufacturing, it's proper to keep what happens in the relocation separate from what happens in the valuation proceeding. So as a matter of law, that evidence should not have come in. Also under the project influence rule in Colorado, which is a long line of cases cited in the briefs, Denver Waste Transfer, I think, is the most recent one. Under project influence rule, evidence that is as a direct result of the taking is not admissible in ascertaining the value of the subject property. In this case, the Will Street property lease wasn't a market transaction. Again, AAA Waterproofing was forced to relocate there. It wasn't a willing lessee or a willing buyer. And because it was forced to move to Willow Street as a result of the acquisition by RTD, that's a project influence fact that the commission shouldn't be considering when valuing the subject property.
Ms. Alderman, so, if the evidence of the Willow Street property was irrelevant, as you're suggesting, why did the commissioners allow it in the first place?
Well, based on the two objections made and what the chair indicated, he suggested that because we were talking about uniqueness of the subject property, and the line of questioning RTD was asking the landowner about was whether Willow Street property was the same or different than the subject property, that they would let it in to go to this uniqueness issue, but not necessarily to value. However, under Marshall Manufacturing and Project Influence Rule, they shouldn't hear anything related to the Willow Street property evidence because that was all involved in the relocation.
So in your view, should the commissioners have disallowed that evidence, or was it within their discretion to allow it as an evidentiary matter?
If it's irrelevant as a matter of law, which is our position, of course, under Marshall Manufacturing and Project Influence, the commission does not have the discretion to admit the evidence. And that's why we have the trial court able to issue instructions on the law after the evidentiary hearing is over. It is an unusual situation to have the judge doing pretrial rulings, the commission making evidentiary rulings, and then the judge instructing on the law at the back end. But one thing to keep in mind, for example, most commissions now have either a lawyer or a retired judge on the commission, but that's not required by statute. It could be three lay people as commissioners. So if they're determining evidentiary decisions and it's wrong as a matter of law, it's the judge's role at the end of the case to instruct them on the law, which is what happened here.
Well, Ms. Alderman, so my understanding is we have to look to the substance of the ruling and whether it's incorrect as a matter of law or not in order to determine whether the court or the commission has the authority to make the ruling?
I think that is the law under Goldstein and under the Mahaffey cases, yes. I mean, if it's simply a question of is it within the scope of direct, for example, yes, the commission gets to make that decision, but if there's law that says that it cannot be considered on this point as a matter of law, the commission doesn't have the discretion to let that in. I mean, another example I could think of maybe is like settlement discussions, right? Maybe they would think those might be relevant to the valuation, but under 403, they're not allowed in. If it comes in, then the judge on the back end should tell them, instruct them that they can't consider it because it's irrelevant as a matter of law. In terms of whether or not there was any error in, if there was error, whether or not it's harmless error, the example RTD provided in their briefs is that they intended to call the owner of the Wall Street property. But I'd just like to note there was an offer proof made, so there's nothing in the record for you to tell if that's something that was harmless or prejudicial. And submit to the court, and you know, through the transcripts you can see RTD offered substantial evidence on whether or not there were over improvements on the subject property. All of their appraisal evidence was in, and so forth. So if there was error here, it was harmless. Moving quickly to the in limine ruling by the judge. So on the motion in limine, she determined at that point she wasn't going to exclude the evidence. So then after 3 days of trial, Mr. Cerny gets on the stand, and the evidence is beginning to be offered again, and we renewed our objection at that point. The commission sustained the objection. In Colorado, under the law in Colorado, in limiting rulings are provisional rulings, and so it was within the authority at that point for the commission to sustain that objection, just as in a regular trial, the judge could have changed her limiting ruling during the course of the trial after hearing the evidence.
Excuse me. Could the one of the parties have asked the judge at that point to, if they were unhappy with the commission's ruling, to weigh in on it?
Actually, the parties are not allowed or permitted to do that by statute. Only the commission can ask the judge to weigh in on evidentiary ruling. So we could not have asked the judge at that point to weigh in on the ruling. And again, the argument that if it was error to sustain that objection, it's on position again, it was harmless. In the briefs, RTD argues it was unfair because the testimony would have rebutted Mr. Clayton's opinion that there was insufficient data to use the income approach. And actually, Mr. Strenny offered all of his opinions regarding the comp sales and comparable income producing properties that were out there. He just was not permitted to get to that last opinion of the average value of 15 industrial properties.
Ms. Alderman, in your brief, you cite various cases for the proposition that a judge can change his or her prior motion or ruling it on a motion in limine. Are you aware of any cases that have held that in connection with an eminent domain proceeding?
Specifically, that if an in limine ruling excludes or doesn't exclude evidence, can the commission then come in?
Right.
Not specifically. I would say just the general theory of Goldstein, that it's within the commission's discretion to make evidentiary rulings, and general case law in Colorado would support that. But I don't know the specific condemnation case.
Okay, thank you.
On the disqualification of commissioner issue, I want to touch upon that because it's important. Well, two things are important about that argument. One, of course, is we have the statute in Colorado that gives the standard for when commissioners are disqualified. And that's exactly what the trial court judge looked at in this case to make her decision. 38.1.1051 expressly says that if the court determines that any of the proposed commissioners is not disinterested and impartial, the court shall replace such person. So that's the standard that our legislature has put in statutes for commissioner disqualification. It doesn't have anything in the statute that says those commissioners should be held to the qualification standards of a judge. Then, of course, we have the Copper Mountain case, which is the Court of Appeals case, the only one we can find other than Mahaffey that talks about disqualification of commissioners. And as explained in the brief, first of all, the case doesn't have a lot of analysis in it. The issue before the court in that case wasn't what is the standard for disqualification. The issue was, did the court err in not disqualifying the commissioner? And the court in that case applied both standards and said that commissioner met both standards, so there was no error. But if you read the case, the holding is not that the both standards must be applied. The court simply applied them both because he met them both and found there was no error in not disqualifying that commissioner. And it's interesting, in that case, the reason for moving to disqualify was that one of the commissioners, the chair, actually received legal referrals from one of the attorneys or the law firm of one of the parties in the case. And I would submit the situation here is even less or more removed than that in terms of the relationship between Ms. Hook and anyone or anything in this case. In terms of the appearance of impropriety standard, which is the standard RTD suggests you should be applying to commissioners, if this court, for some reason, despite the statutory language, were to find that that standard would apply to commissioners, there is a sufficient record here for you to determine that there's no appearance of impropriety in terms of Ms. Hook serving on the commission. And if the court were to remand the case for some reason on that point, it would be strictly to have further voir dire and findings on that point. There's not grounds for a new trial based on this issue. Ms. one of the cases to look at as well on this point is the Mahaffey case, because in that case, it wasn't a disqualification motion on the front end, it was a recusal issue on the back end, a motion for a new trial. And in Mahaffey, the court said that absent a showing of improper conduct on the commissioner's part, the court must assume the commissioner did not violate his oath.
So we... excuse me, but your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Rodriguez, you have 47 seconds.
All right, to address a slightly related issue that Judge Tubman asked, counsel indicated that evidentiary decisions that are interlocutory can be rescinded, I submit to you, not by non-presiding trial court judge who does not sit as a reviewing court judge. Judge, you had indicated the issue of, well, isn't this really a question of what was the substantive issue? And we said it is. And how can a trial court who doesn't preside over a trial make a decision which doesn't even understand the substance of what the evidence was and when it was presented to the court? Marshall Manufacturing does not apply. We were not asking for payment of relocation expenses. We were not asking to deduct any commission amounts. We were asking for attributes of properties that could be compensable and likened to the subject property. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. And the bailiff may announce the recess.